You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community, and we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. If you've driven I-90 in Bellevue, 405 near Renton or State Route 305 on Bainbridge lately, you've likely run into construction, and that means shut down lanes, redirected routes, and the knowledge that you're now definitely going to be late for that appointment you swore you'd be on time for. And much of that work is being done to help some fish. The state has been ordered by a judge to fix culverts running under our ever-expanding urban sprawl to allow threatened salmon to reach their spawning grounds. But is all this construction actually helping salmon? That's a question raised in a new report by Seattle Times investigative journalist Mike Riker. He says the state will spend an estimated $7.8 billion on restoring salmon habitat by 2030. But the potential outcome of all that spending is as murky as a stream full of silt. And he joins me now to explain. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me.
So, Mike, let's go back to the basics here. Remind us, why is Washington slated to spend $7.8 billion, which you note is the cost of replacing the old Highway 99 viaduct twice over, on salmon restoration? What's behind all this?
Sure. So this particular program is the most expensive salmon recovery program in the state's history. And it dates back to 2001, when a group of 21 Northwest tribes sued the state of Washington for blocking salmon and steelhead trout passage under state highways. So as we all know, salmon migrate upstream, and there are these things under roads and highways everywhere you drive in this part of the state in western Washington called culverts. And culverts are basically big pipes or concrete tunnels that can carry a stream or a creek underneath a roadway. But in many cases, they're designed in a way that actually blocks salmon migration. And the tribe sued because they have fishing rights based on their treaties that they signed in the 1850s. And a federal court found that the state was violating their treaty rights by having these culverts under the roads that blocked fish. In other words, they degraded their fishing stocks. And so the court back in 2013 ordered the state to replace or repair their culverts all across western Washington. And the State Department of Transportation has been working on it since. And it really ramped up in the last couple of years. Many listeners have probably sat in traffic at one of these construction sites where the state's pulling out these culverts, multi-million dollar projects, and making them fish passable by building bridges or bigger culverts that kind of simulate an actual stream.
$7.8 billion, and as you report, it's about $1 million a day now. Where's that funding coming from?
Most of it is state taxpayer dollars. A relatively small portion is coming from federal sources. There are federal monies available through the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed a few years ago. But so far, Washington, the State Department of Transportation has not really taken advantage of those funds. So, the vast majority of it is taxpayer funds.
Now, you report that for all the money being spent on these culverts, the efforts may not actually result in significantly more salmon spawning in Washington state. What's the problem with the way the state is approaching culvert restoration, Mike?
Right. So the most interesting part of our reporting was finding these projects that just didn't make any sense for fish. The state would pull out a culvert, tear up the highway and build a new bridge. But just upstream or downstream, there would be another culvert or a dam, a small dam. We're not talking about big hydropower dams. But these other man-made obstacles are blocking fish, in many cases, from even getting to the culvert that the state just replaced, or getting far beyond it. So, if you step back and look at the big picture, there are actually more than 17,000 fish passage barriers on the state's landscape. And these are owned by homeowners, by cities, counties, railroads, you name it. All these parties have these culverts and dams that are blocking fish. So that is one huge issue. And basically, the state is following the letter of the injunction, the federal court order that requires them to replace these culverts. And the judge ordered the Department of Transportation to replace most of their culverts by 2030. And right now, the state is in a mad rush to meet that deadline. So the way that they measure success is by measuring the amount of potential fish habitat upstream of their culverts. And they have to add up all that mileage to get to a number that the judge has specified.
But it doesn't matter if the fish are actually using that potential habitat, because as you mentioned, oftentimes these repairs are happening in areas that are blocked upstream by various privately owned obstacles. So really, this is just about, as you say, the letter of the law versus how things work in practice.
Right. So, yeah, the big question is, what do the fish actually need? And, you know, you'll talk to some people in salmon recovery, and including at the tribes and at the state, who say that the idea is all these man-made barriers will eventually be removed. It's this idea of they're playing the long game. But most of them have no plans for removal. We took a look at this this one project in Bellevue. It's the most expensive project that the state's working on right now. It's $110 million to replace to install bridges on I-90, and it's going over this obscure stream in Bellevue called Sunset Creek. And just upstream is a barrier, essentially like a man-made waterfall that the fish cannot get past. And upstream of that are four other complete barriers. And so, you know, if a fish makes it all the way to this $110 million project, it won't get more than half a mile upstream. But the state says that that entire creek is potential habitat.
Wow. So who owns these other barriers, Mike? The state can replace parts of I-90 to the tune of $110 million to raise it up and protect that creek. But who owns these other, the boulders, the man-made waterfall, the pipes that will block the fish just a third of a mile away?
So the next upstream barrier at Sunset Creek is owned by the city of Bellevue. And it's a culvert that runs under a middle school running track. And at the downstream end of it, there's this big drop off. Like, you know, we've seen pictures of salmon jumping, but if they have to jump 3 feet or more, it's considered a barrier. And you can picture them trying to jump 5 feet into like a tube, essentially a concrete tube.
Yeah, I mean, salmon can do amazing things when they're trying to come upstream to spawn, but a 5 foot jump is not going to happen. Yeah.
Right, right. And so, yeah, the city of Bellevue has looked at this stream, and they did a big watershed assessment, and it just does not rank high. Like they've thought about daylighting that portion of that creek, but they have other streams in their city that are higher priority and have more fish potential. And that was really common across Western Washington when we were looking at projects, that the state would be working on a highway, but nearby the cities and the counties and the local restoration groups had their own priorities. They knew what the area needs to bring back fish, and it many times doesn't jive with what the state was working on.
I'm talking with the Seattle Times' Mike Riker, an investigative journalist who looked at the state's multi-billion dollar culvert recovery program. It's been mandated under a ruling by a federal judge, and how inefficient some of the projects appear to be when you look at streams that are actually being used by salmon and where the blockages are. If the tribes were to try to compel these other entities, local governments, private homeowners, businesses, to clear the waterways so the culvert replacement by the state would actually be effective, what would that take? I mean, individual lawsuits against everyone who owns every piece of land?
Well, one potential that people in salmon recovery and in state and local government have been looking out for a while is that the local governments are potential targets of litigation by the tribes. So county governments own the most culverts that block fish besides private landowners. More than WSDOT, actually, these county roads are all over the state. And so the tribes could go back to federal court and seek to get an order for the counties and the cities to remove their barriers. When it comes to private owners, it's a different story. The Department of Fish and Wildlife actually has an enforcement ability where they could go onto somebody's property and order them to remove their culvert if it's blocking fish migration. And they could even go in and build a culvert if the owner refuses to do it and put a lien on that property, on that person's house, for instance. But the state's never actually done that. In the history of the state, it's been on the books for decades. And Fish and Wildlife is actually working on some new rules right now that will give them some other enforcement options. So the private barriers are a really tricky, kind of thorny issue. Like, how do you compel people to fix their blockages in the streams?
Yeah. So this is a multi-billion dollar effort by the state. $1 million a day. Taxpayer money being spent on replacing culverts. And the state is really racing to meet this 2030 deadline set by the judge, as you report, Mike. Now, because of this rush and because they're trying to meet the letter of the ruling and not necessarily benefit salmon to the maximum, we're seeing a lot of these projects that are big and expensive projects, but as you say, an average of 9 other blockages on these waterways, meaning they're not really that effective currently at allowing fish passage. What's been the response from state officials when you bring these issues up to them? I mean, are they aware that this process is seemingly flawed?
Sure. They know that the other barriers are on the stream and that they are doing the projects anyway. And their main response is we're ordered by a federal judge and there's no getting around that. And that's true. But we found some opportunities that the state has had that they've missed to make these actually more effective. But one thing I should definitely say is there are some state fish passage projects that have been very successful, right? The science is indisputable. If you take out a barrier to salmon migration, the fish will come back and they'll spawn in that stream. It's just a generally accepted idea. But the question is, which of these do you fix first? And how do you work with the local parties to make sure that the stream is actually accessible? We found that the state hasn't coordinated as much as it could with local governments and other parties to fix their barriers in the stream, the other barriers. We found that the state could go back to court. That was left open specifically when the injunction was, the court order was made back in 2013. And it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and repeatedly the tribes said, you know, if it's not working out for the state, they can go back to the judge and ask for the injunction to be modified. But the state has resisted doing that. I talked to Governor Inslee, and he, in an interview, said that it was really the federal judicial decision that is driving all of this, and you can't blame the state for what he said were, quote, misprioritizations. But like I said, there are opportunities that the state has passed up to make these more effective.
I mean, it feels like there just needs to be like one czar, for lack of a better word, salmon czar, that coordinates with local governments and private landowners and the state's efforts. Is there any indication that communication will improve?
Well, it's interesting. In 2021, the state legislature was aware of this problem, that there were billions that the state was spending on projects, and many of them had these other barriers. And they directed the Inslee administration, multiple departments within the administration, to come up with a strategy. So to look at the problem more holistically, like you have all these other barriers, you know, which ones are the highest priority that will get the best or the most fish now? And the state had a long delay during the COVID pandemic, and they don't expect to have a report finalized until next year. In the meantime, there's been a lot of federal funds that have become available, and some people I talked to said it was a missed opportunity for the state. If they had had this strategic plan that identified the other culverts that would really leverage the investment that the state has made, then they could have gone after this more than $1 billion of federal funding to really tackle these streams. But yeah, the coordination is important, and I don't know if it will change. Maybe when they get this strategy, maybe before. I don't know.
It's just so mind-boggling to think of $110 million being spent to raise I-90 to free up this creek to allow the salmon to pass, and yet these dinky little obstacles just a few hundred yards away are blocking the benefit of that huge, massive state project. And you just can't believe that there isn't a better way to go about this, Mike. But it sounds like there might be some greater reporting coming from you as the state's review is released. Mike Riker is an investigative reporter with the Seattle Times. Read his story in the Times. It's called Removing Washington Salmon Barriers Surges to 1 Million a Day, but Results Are Murky. Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.